يتأبنه يتأبنه مارك تشارلز ينشيا تسن بكيدنا نشلن تتو هغليني باشتشين تسن بكيدنا باشتشي دو تو تشيتني باشنلا. In the Navajo culture, when you introduce yourself, we always give our four clans. We're a matrilineal people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. So my mother's mother happens to be American of Dutch heritage. And so in my introduction, I say, which translated means I'm from the wooden shoe people. My father's mother, my second clan, is Toa Higlini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Tsinbeke Dine'e. And then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Totochitni, and that's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. Before we go on any further, I want to just pause and acknowledge that we are standing on the land of the Potawatomi and the Haudenosaunee. These are the tribes who lived here. They had societies here. They farmed, they hunted, they fished here. They had villages, they had commerce here. And these were the tribes that were ethnically cleansed from these lands so that the city of Akron, the city of Cleveland could be built, so that the state of Ohio could be established, so that white settlement and white civilization could come in. And I just like to acknowledge wherever I go and wherever I speak, the people whose land I'm standing on. It helps me to remember that Columbus didn't discover America. Right? You can't discover lands already inhabited. And so it gives me a more humble stance to remember not only the people who lived here for hundreds, some even thousands of years, but the violence and the injustice that was enacted so that even this church could be built and this town could be established. Are there anyone here from the Haudenosaunee or the Potawatomi tribes with us today? Okay. I always like to ask just because I do not ever want to presume to talk on someone else's land without at least acknowledging and giving them a chance to greet and to acknowledge their presence in our midst. The title of my sermon today, and I'm gonna back over here so I don't have to keep turning around in circles. The title of my sermon today is, "Do You Believe in Jesus?" And if we go into the Gospel of Mark, notably chapter 8, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus spends the whole first half of the Gospel trying to help people understand that he is the Son of God. He heals people, he raises people from the dead, he calms the sea, he casts out demons. He sends his disciples and empowers them, gives them authority to go out and teach in his name. And in chapter 8, he's with his disciples, and he's asking them, and he says, okay, you've been with me for a while. We've been going at this for a year or two. Who do people think I am? Disciples say, well, some people think you're Elijah. A few think you're John the Baptist, because he was killed earlier in the gospel. And some think you're one of the old prophets. Jesus said, well, who do you say I am? Peter said, you're the Messiah. Now, if the goal was just to believe in Jesus, if that was the goal, this is the end of the gospel, right? The disciples get it. Jesus is the Messiah. He can now elevate up into heaven, and his work is done. But understanding Jesus is the Messiah is just the first part of discipleship. Jesus then immediately begins to teach the disciples that the Son of Man, the Messiah, must suffer, must be captured, and must be persecuted, and ultimately must die crucified on a cross. Now, this is so outside of the thinking of the disciples. They're waiting for a political Messiah to come and free them from the Roman oppressors. They're waiting for someone to come in strength to legislate their theologies and to bring them back to the greatness of the kingdom of David, that this blows Peter's mind, and he has the arrogance to pull Jesus aside and rebuke him. You don't have to die, Jesus. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God. And Jesus turns around and he sees the other disciples. And he turns to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan. You are not on the side of God, but of men. And this begins a very tense part of his relationship with his disciples, where he is trying to teach them that he is the Messiah, must suffer and be persecuted and die and sacrifice his life, and that they, as his disciples, will also be persecuted and mistreated, and that's actually part of the plan. And the disciples don't get it. And one day, he's with his disciples, and they say to Jesus that he's already given them the authority to cast out demons. He's already given them the authority to teach. He's already chosen them and drawn them near to him. And they're sitting aside one day, and the disciples come to Jesus and say, "Hey, Jesus, we found this guy, and he was casting out demons. But because he wasn't one of us, the chosen ones, we told him to stop." Good job, right? Just no! Don't tell him to stop! Anyone who does something good in my name, even giving someone a cup of water, can no longer turn against us. And then, he doesn't stop there. He goes into this teaching and he says, if you cause one of these little ones who believes in me to sin, it would be better if you tied a millstone around your neck and threw yourself into the sea. If by creating these categories of other and belittling and dehumanizing these people who aren't with us, it would be better if your hand causes you to believe you're better than others, chop it off, because it's better to enter life maimed with only one hand than with two hands to be cast into hell. And if your foot causes you to think you're better than the others and that you are somehow more chosen and more privileged, then chop your foot off. Because it's better to limp your way into heaven than to go with 2 feet believing you're better with other people. A few chapters later, Jesus with his disciples, they've gone into Samaria. Now the people of Israel are under judgment. They are not worshiping freely. They're oppressed by the Romans. They have a land covenant with the God of Israel, and their land covenant is a barometer of their relationship with God. When they're obedient, they are blessed and they flourish and they thrive on their land. When they are disobedient, he removes them from their land. So they're in a quasi mode. They're on their land, but they're not free. They're under the oppression of the Romans. And part of the reason they are most likely under judgment by God is because of the Samaritans. The Samaritans have intermarried. The Samaritans have taken wives from other nations and they have worshipped other gods. In fact, they're not even worshipping the temple anymore. They are now worshipping on this mountain. And so there's a good chance that the people of Israel are under oppression because of the Samaritans. Now, Jesus sends the disciples out to go into Samaria to prepare the way for him. And the Samaritans reject Jesus and the disciples. And so as they're walking away from that village, James and John, the sons of thunder, are kind of excited. And they're like, cool, we got rejected. Jesus, can I be the one to call down fire from heaven and destroy them? Right, this is what happens in the Old Testament. You disobey God, he sent a prophet, you listen to the prophet, he has mercy and forgives you. You reject the prophet. Fire and brimstone, baby. Do you remember Sodom and Gomorrah? Do you remember Elijah and the prophets of Baal? This is why Jonah didn't want to go into Nineveh, right? He wanted God to destroy the city. He knew if they repented, God would have mercy. He didn't even want to go. The disciples are like, cool, they rejected us. This is our dream. We get to destroy Samaria. Who wouldn't want to be the one to call down fire from heaven? But Jesus is like, no, you don't get it. And he rebukes them and then takes them into another Samaritan village. The disciples they don't understand the role of the Messiah. They know Jesus, they believe he's God, but they don't understand the role of the Messiah. At the end of his ministry, Jesus warns the disciples that persecution is going to come. He takes them with him into the garden, and he's praying. pleading with God that this cup might pass from him, praying for strength that he might be able to endure this persecution he does not want to endure. Telling God, please, please, please take this cup from me. And every time he goes back to check on his disciples, what are they doing? They're sleeping. It's like, guys, can't you even stay awake for an hour? Come on, you need to be praying too. Persecution is coming. He goes back a third time and he releases his will to God. Not my will, God, may your will be done. The soldiers come in. They arrest Jesus. Peter, who's been sleeping and not praying, takes out his sword and slashes out of a guy's ear. Right? Because he has some power. You don't have to die, Jesus. I'm going to protect you. Jesus rebukes Peter, picks up the guy's ear, puts it back on. You know, like, this is what we're doing here. And then all of them flee. They leave Jesus alone, by himself, in the custody of the Roman Empire. He's taken. He's standing before Pilate. Pilate doesn't want to kill Jesus. He doesn't want to crucify him. He's asking him questions. And Jesus is not saying anything. Finally, Pilate, so frustrated, he says, don't you know I have the power to set you free or to kill you? Jesus said, you have no authority over me. The only authority you have is what my Father in heaven gave to you. You're just a pawn in this whole thing. My kingdom's not of this earth. If my kingdom were here, my servants, the angels, would come and set me free. My kingdom is somewhere else, he said. Crucify me. The only reason Jesus died, the only reason he suffered, the only reason he was persecuted, the only reason he was crucified is because he submitted himself unto death, even death on a cross. Why? Because he knew the role of the Messiah. The Messiah had to suffer. He had to die. He had to offer his body as a living sacrifice. And it wasn't until he was crucified and buried and rose from the dead and appeared to his disciples several times and then gets taken up into heaven in front of them. But it's not until Acts chapter 2 when God gives the gift of the Holy Spirit that the disciples finally get it. They finally get it. They finally understand the role of the Messiah. And almost all of the disciples go on to become persecuted for the sake of the gospel. Almost all of the disciples die a martyr's death, beginning with Stephen. They finally got it. Now, the early church, the first century church, when you joined the church through your baptism, your confession, your discipleship, and your community, you knew that you were standing in opposition to the empire. You knew that your role was to prophesy and to speak the truth. You knew that the institutionalized religious establishment and the empire of the government was going to be opposed to you. You knew that because of what you were doing, there was a chance you would be persecuted and maybe even killed because of your faith. And then the 300s, Constantine becomes emperor of Rome. Now, I've taught on this history for a long time, and I've always blamed Christendom on Constantine. He is this baby Christian who sees a vision of God that he should conquer under this cross, and he Christianizes Rome. He imposes Christendom upon the church, is how I've always taught this. Well, I'm writing a book on the doctrine of discovery. And I was doing some research because I wanted to include this vision of this cross into the first chapter of my book. And I started doing some more reading into Constantine, especially into Eusebius, who's the bishop of Caesarea, who is the historian who writes the history of Constantine, the life of Constantine, and he records the vision that Constantine saw. But that book doesn't get published until even after Constantine's dead. It doesn't get published until 339. There's another book he writes while Constantine's alive. It gets published in 325, just before the Council of Nicaea. This book is called Ecclesiastical History, the history of the church, right? And actually, it's a very useful historical tool because he basically starts with establishing, it's a volume of 11 books, and he starts in books 1 and 2 establishing the divinity of Christ, and then beginning with Stephen and going through 325, he talks about the martyrs of the church. And we hear about the spread of the gospel, and we hear about the people who died so that the gospel could be spread. We hear about how they went to their graves with peace in their heart and smiles on their faces because they were sharing in the suffering of Christ. But then in book 8, there's a change. And he introduces Constantine's father. And he's a chosen emperor by God for such a time as this. And it seems out of place. And then he introduces Constantine's son, who is God's vessel to lead this Roman Empire, chosen and ordained by God. And it seems out of place because the whole volume is about the persecution of the church from the Roman Empire. And this seems out of place. And then between books 8 and book 9, there's another book called the Book of the Martyrs, which talks about the great persecution which took place in 303 AD. And 13 of these chapters, there's 13 chapters, and they lay out in gruesome, gory detail the martyrs of the great persecution. And almost all of the examples are from Caesarea or Palestine, which is where Eusebius lived. And many of them, he says, he saw their martyrdom personally. In book 9, he goes back into his narration, and he talks about the battle at Milvian Bridge, which is where Constantine supposedly saw this vision. And he compares the battle and Constantine's victory to Moses' victory over Pharaoh at the Red Sea. And then book 10. Now, if we're honest, a book called Ecclesiastical History, a history of the church, would not have an ending, am I correct? It would be the start of a great story that continues until what? Until Christ returns. But book 10 very much does have a conclusion. I want to just read you a few phrases from book 10. This is half sermon, half history lesson because we have to understand the mess that we're sitting in. In book 10, which is called the chapter 10, of book 10 is titled The Victory of Constantine and the Blessing Under Him Accrued to the Whole Roman World. And it describes how after Constantine consolidated power and became the emperor of Rome and killed off the other emperors, that all of the people were celebrating with joy and hilarity. And he says, and at the same time, they celebrated and exalted, first of all, God, the universal king, because thus they were taught. Then they celebrated the praises of the pious emperor. Who do they skip? Jesus, right? He says there was nothing but enjoyment of the present blessing and the expectations of yet to come because of the victories of Constantine. And then he goes on to say, the supreme God granted from heaven above the fruits of his piety, the trophies of victory over the wicked, and the Narcissus tyrant and all his counselors and adherents, and he cast prostrate them at the feet of Constantine. Do you see what he's done? Christendom, Christian empire, is completely opposed to Christ. Christ did not come to establish Christian empire. He came to plant a church. He did not come to save his life. He came to lose it. He did not come to conquer his enemies. He came to die for them. So if you're going to have a Christian empire, the first thing you have to do is remove Christ. And Eusebius does that. In his book, Ecclesiastical History, there is absolutely a conclusion, and ecclesiastical history, according to Eusebius, ends with not the coming of Christ, but the reign of Constantine. Now, in the 5th century, Augustine begins writing, and he's in a whole new world. He's in a Christian empire. What do we do with Christian empire? And he begins reflecting at the end of his life on the Donatists, who are a heretical group, and he's wondering, what is the role of a Christian king in a Christian empire? We've never had these things before. The church has always been oppressed. Now, instead of joining the church through your baptism and your confession, now you're a member of the church because of your citizenship in the most powerful empire in the world. And so Augustine begins writing, and he concludes that the role of the Christian king in the Christian empire is to prevent and chastise with religious severity all those acts which are done in opposition to the commands of the Lord. That the Christian king in the Christian empire serves the Lord by enforcing with suitable rigor laws as ordained what is righteous, and he punishes what is the reverse. He goes on to conclude that it's better that people come to worship God through sound teaching. But he says, but which of us have not experienced people who first being compelled to worship God through fear, punishment, and pain, so that later they might respond to teaching? So Augustine is literally writing and saying the role of the Christian king in the Christian empire is to punish people, cause fear and pain in them, to compel them to worship God. It's no surprise this leads into the Crusades, which is about expanding empire and protecting Jerusalem. Then, in the 10th, 11th centuries, Aquinas begins writing, and he's also dealing with the heretics. And he argues and says that if the secular authority can kill people because they break man's laws, how much more authority does the church have to kill people who break God's laws? So if someone's convicted and found guilty of heresy, we not only need to execute them, we get to kill them. In the 13th century, the church begins using a new term in their writings called the infidel. This is the category of other. It's a subhuman category. It's used for the Moors, the Muslims. Later, it's applied to indigenous peoples. Now that we have a category of other, now this justifies our wars. We're not killing people. We're killing the enemies of God. We don't even need Augustine's just war theory anymore. And so in 1452, this is what allows Pope Nicholas V to write out the words, invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and to their use and profit. This papal bull, along with other papal bulls written between 1452 and 1493, collectively become known as what we call the Doctrine of Discovery. The Doctrine of Discovery is essentially the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever lands you find not ruled by white European Christian rulers, those people are subhuman and the land is yours to take. This is literally the doctrine that let European nations go into Africa, colonize the continent, and enslave the people. They weren't human. It's the same doctrine that let Columbus, who was lost at sea, land in this new world that's already inhabited by millions and claim to have discovered it. You can't discover lands already inhabited, right? If you don't believe me, leave your cell phones, your car keys, your laptops out. I'll come by and discover them. Clearly, it's not discovery, right? This is colonizing, this is stealing, this is conquering. The fact that tomorrow we are going to honor Christopher Columbus as the discoverer of America reveals the implicit racial bias of our nation, which is Native peoples, people of color, are not fully human. The doctrine of discovery is a white, male, Christian supremacist doctrine That is the direct fruit of the church rejecting Christ and prostituting itself out to the empire. Now, the problem is this doctrine has been embedded into the foundations of our country. It's the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths that all men are created equal. 30 lines later, in the Declaration, it refers to natives as merciless Indian savages. The only reason our founding fathers used this inclusive term all men, they had a very narrow definition of who was actually human. The Constitution starts with the words, we the people. Article 1, Section 2, the section that defines who is and who is not protected by the Constitution, who is and who is not a part of this union, it never mentions women. It specifically excludes natives, and it counts Africans as 3/5 of a person. Who's left? White, technically landowning men. This is the purpose of our Constitution, to protect white landowning men. Now, in 1823, we had a Supreme Court case. This is Johnson versus McIntosh. It's two men of European descent. They're litigating over a single piece of land. One of them got the land from a native tribe. The other one got the same land from the government, and they want to know who owned it. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court has to decide the principle upon which land titles are based. This is the John Marshall Court. And they rule that the principle is that discovery gives title to the land. And then they reference the doctrine of discovery as a legal instrument and use that to determine that natives who are here first but are less than human, we only have what's called the aboriginal title, the right of occupancy to the land. Like a fish occupies water, a bird occupies air. And Europeans have the fee title, the right of discovery to the land, and therefore they are the true title holders. This case in 1823 creates the legal precedent for land titles. This precedent and the doctrine of discovery are referenced by name by the Supreme Court in 1954, in 1985, and most recently in 2005. I want to talk about this 2005 case. It happened in the city of Sherrill in New York. The Oneida Nation that had lived there long before Columbus got lost. They were removed from this land to other places around the country. And in the 1900s, they came back and they bought some of their previous land on the open market. They paid fair price for it. They wanted to add this land to their federal treaty lands, their trust lands, their reservation. If you didn't know, we don't own our reservation lands. Our reservation lands are held in trust for us by the government, so we don't actually own our lands because we're native and we can't own land. And they wanted to add this to their federal trust lands, which aren't taxable. Well, the city of Sherrill wanted the tax revenue, and so they sued. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and so the court has to decide what to do. So the court rules, and I just want to read some of these readings from what they rule, because it's kind of fascinating. They basically say, since you've waited so long, from 1600 till now, to try and fix this, and since the land has been opened up to settlement by white people, and large portions of them are now in the hands of innocent purchasers, and because we brought in civilization and the value of the land is so much greater now than it used to be, we now reject the unification theory of the Oneida Indian Nation and the United States and hold that the standards of federal Indian law, and they reference the doctrine of discovery by name in the footnotes because it's the standard of federal Indian law, and federal equity practice preclude the tribe from rekindling embers of sovereignty that long ago grew cold. This is 2005. Anyone want to guess who wrote this opinion? Anyone want to guess? Scalia? Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's done amazing things for women's rights. But absolutely, she's a white supremacist. Now, in 1630, John Winthrop was in the Boston Harbor. It's now called the Boston Harbor. He was with a group of colonists. They were here to plant the Boston colony. And he preached a sermon called A Model of Christian Charity. In his sermon, he referred to the colonists as a city on a hill. He's borrowing from the language of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, be a lamp on a stand, a city on a hill, shine your good deeds into this dark world. He goes on to exhort them in all meekness, gentleness, patience, liberality, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together. These are just your common basic Presbyterian church exhortations. At the end of his sermon, he's trying to convince the people to adhere to his exhortations, and so he quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 30. Now, Deuteronomy 30 is the passage in the Old Testament where the people of Israel are standing at the banks of the Jordan River, ready to cross over and take possession of their promised lands. And God's reiterating the threats and promises of his land covenant. If you obey me, I'll do these things to you. If you disobey me, I'll do these things to you. End of this passage, it says, but if we shall disobey and turn from God, but if our hearts shall turn away and we will not obey and we worship other gods, we will surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over this river to possess it. Now, Deuteronomy 30 says river, but in his sermon, John Winthrop says vast sea. Why would he say vast sea? Well, they didn't cross the river, they crossed an ocean. So what's he implying? Based on Jesus' exhortation to be a city on a hill, based on Old Testament Israel's land covenant with God, they are here at the shores of their promised land, ready to take possession of them. Now, who here has read the book of Deuteronomy or Joshua? How are the Israelites supposed to take possession of Canaan? What do they do to the Canaanites? Kill everybody. It literally says, leave no man, no woman, no child, no animal left alive. Promised lands for one people is literally God-ordained genocide for another. I call this sermon the birth of American exceptionalism. The idea percolates for about 100 years. Mid-1700s, we go past the Appalachian Mountains, we go past the Mississippi River. End of the 1700s, there's the Second Great Awakening, there's a growth in churches, a renewal of denominations, there's this religious fervor as we're moving westward. 1840, the term manifest destiny is coined. The belief that this nation has the God-given right to rule these lands from sea to shining sea. This is literally the narrative of our country. This is embedded in what I would call our codependent, dysfunctional relationship with the nation state of Israel. 3 years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu was in the U.S. and he was lobbying against the Iran nuclear deal. And he spoke to a joint session of Congress. He had a very divided, a very partisan Congress. They weren't even talking to each other. Several people boycotted the speech. And he had to get everyone on the same page behind him. So early in his speech, he said, because America and Israel, we share a common destiny, a destiny of promised lands. To bipartisan applause. See, we need Old Testament Israel, because their legacy of promised lands justifies our treatment of Native Americans and African Americans. And they need us because our flourishing as a God-blessed, God-ordained nation justifies their ongoing oppression against the Palestinians and the Bedouins. We have a very dysfunctional, codependent relationship with the nation-state of Israel, and it has nothing to do with human rights. It's all about justifying our past and our present. So, this leads into a history of Indian massacres, boarding schools, westward expansion. And I want to talk about boarding schools. They're introduced in the 1870s, 1880s. In the 1890s, 1892 actually, after the massacre at Wounded Knee, 350 Dakota men, women, and children were slaughtered in a single day at Wounded Knee. We gave 20 Congressional Medals of Honor to the U.S. soldiers who participated in this massacre. The nation's losing its appetite for genocide a little bit. But we still have all these natives. And so they have what's called the Indian problem. What do we do with these Indians? We want their land, but it's getting harder and harder to justify outright killing them. And so in 1892, Richard Pratt, who is the father of the Indian boarding school, gives a speech, and he addresses the Indian problem. And he says, you know, rather than killing the Indians, we should kill the Indian to save the man. We should forcibly assimilate them to U.S. culture and civilization. And so this ushers in the era of Indian boarding schools, where children are taken from their homes, they're beaten for speaking their language, they're punished for practicing their culture. The stories of assault, rape, abuse, neglect that happen in these boarding schools are absolutely sickening. And to justify him, he says, you know, as horrible as slavery was, it gave the Negro the greatest blessing they've ever received, which is it brought them from cannibalism and savagery in Africa to partial citizenship and civilized here in America. Since left in Africa, surrounded by their fellow savages, our 7 million industrious black fellow citizens would still be savages. Transferred here into these new surroundings and experiences, behold the result. They became English-speaking and civilized. And how did this happen so quickly? Through the influences of association. Scattered here and there under the care and authority of individuals of the higher race, they learned self-support and something of citizenship, and so reached their present place. No other influence or force could have so speedily accomplished such a result. This is the problem. To the white supremacist mind, the most charitable, the most benevolent thing you can do is allow people of the subhuman races to associate with you, to become like you. Think about why is a core value of America assimilation. How many of our mission agencies get their foot in the door by doing what? Teaching English. Now the CRC participated. They bought into this lie. In the early 1900s, they sent some missionaries from their Board of Heathen Missions out to New Mexico. And they purchased some land and they called it Rehoboth. This came from Genesis. It means God has given us room and we shall flourish in the land. Now, God didn't give the CRC this land. This land was ethnically cleansed by Abraham Lincoln in the 1960s through an experience known as the Long Walk. See, Abraham Lincoln was actually our most genocidal president. In 1862, he signed the Pacific Railway Act, giving land and resources for the completion of the Transcontinental Railway. There were three proposed routes, one through Minnesota, one through Omaha, Colorado, and Wyoming, and one through the territory of New Mexico. And with 2.5 years of signing that bill, he has ethnically cleansed all of the tribes from Minnesota, from Colorado, and from New Mexico. This is actually why he's our greatest president, because he completed our manifest destiny. He completed the genocide of Native peoples. And so Rehoboth bought this ethnically cleansed land, or the CRC bought it, and they established a mission school there. In 1904, Henry Beats, one of the early CRC missionaries, he wrote, as our Navajo converts multiply, the pressing question will be more and more, what shall we do with them and for them? We certainly cannot leave them to sift for themselves as well as they can. Religious, social, and natural conditions seem to forbid this. Now, in 2016, I was a part of a CRC task force and we brought a report to the Synod of the CRC about the doctrine of discovery and our intersection with it, which was Rehoboth. Our report included two testimonies of boarding school survivors, one from a BIA, a government boarding school, and one from Rehoboth. We sent our report to the Board of Trustees, and they pulled the story of the Rehoboth boarding school survivor from the report for pastoral reasons. And so the public report that went forward, the one that you can read online, does not include that story. At Synod, we were sitting there. Now, I knew this was going to be a hard conversation. I knew this was going to be a challenging conversation for us. And so they asked me to open our time for this discussion in prayer. And we're Reformed as a denomination. We believe in the depravity of all humans. We believe we are saved by faith, not by works. And I reminded our Synod delegates about this because I knew they were going to be struggling to justify themselves in light of this report. And so the report comes up, and we begin discussing it, and they put a resolution on the floor. And the resolution says, the Synod acknowledges that the existing doctrine of discovery is a heresy, and we reject and condemn it. It helped shape Western culture and led to great injustices. It's not a bad statement, right? It got adopted and passed, I think almost unanimously, very quickly. But then, and you can go online and watch the video of this session, it's actually fascinating, Synod immediately pivots, and they go into a 20-minute period of sharing about how great our boarding school was. And then they pass a resolution that says, the Synod nevertheless recognize also the great motivation in response to the Great Commission, as well as the love and grace extended over many years by missionaries sent out from the CRCNA to the indigenous peoples of Canada and the U.S. And for this, we give God thanks and honor their dedication. And that also got adopted and passed. So what's my point? What's my point? Because the vast majority of our people in this country, Christians, they believe Jesus is God, but they don't understand the role of the Messiah. And because back in the 3rd century, we rejected Christ and made empire Constantine our Savior, we live in what's now Christendom. So the American church doesn't consider itself a part of a global body of believers. And even if we do, we think we're the head, which is heresy. No, we're connected to each other. The CRC is connected to the Methodists connected to the Catholics connected to the Presbyterians connected to the Anabaptists. How? Because we all live in a Christian empire. We live in a Christian nation. We are an exceptional people. We have promised lands. So because of this, if you murder somebody, if you rob somebody, if you commit adultery with somebody, the church can help you. The church can offer you Christ if you sin individually. But if you go to the church and try to address multi-generational systemic corporate sin, the church has no one there because that's a sin of the church. That's a sin of Christendom. And Christ has been removed from Christendom. And I would argue that Constantine replaced Messiah in Roman times. Our Messiah, and you can listen to my lectures online if you want more detail on this, I would say our Messiah is Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln's blood doesn't do squat for you. He was the most white supremacist genocidal president in the history of our nation. And if you don't believe me, go online and listen to my lectures. So when the church is confronted with multi-generational systemic corporate sin, it has no theological space to wrestle with it. Which is why the CRC, which believes in the depravity of all people, and we're saved by faith and not by works, when it was confronted with corporate multi-generational systemic sin, what did it do? It immediately pivoted to its works. Because Christendom rejects Christ. And we bought into the lie of Christendom. Therefore, we have no theological space to do. And it's not just our church. All the American churches have done this. See, in the Gospels, the people of Israel are waiting for a political Messiah. They're waiting for someone to restore the greatness of the kingdom of Israel, to make Israel great again. And all the people expected this. In fact, one day Jesus was out and he had just healed the servant of a centurion, a Roman centurion, and he had raised the son of a widow from the dead. Neither of these were helpful in establishing a Christian empire. John the Baptist, who was trumpeting Jesus' coming, was so confused by this, he sent his disciples to Jesus to say, hey, are you the one who we're looking for? Or are we supposed to wait for somebody else? I love Jesus' response. Jesus says to them, to him, to the disciples, he says that, it says at that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many of those who were blind. So he replied to the messengers, go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised, and good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. Jesus said, you have two choices. You can build a Christian empire and kill everybody. Or you can follow me and heal a very broken and hurting world. And for 2,000 years, the church has been killing everybody. And we have to repent. We have to turn around. We have to reject the notion of Christian empire. We have to reject the heresy of Christendom. And we have to embrace Christ. The United States of America is not, never has been, nor will it ever be Christian. Donald Trump is an absolute nightmare, but the Democrats do not have the answer. What our nation needs is a separate, independent, prophetic church that is willing to speak truth to power. Many people would say we had a lot of social justice organizations in the early 2000s who were speaking truth to George Bush about the Iraq war, about our dependence on oil. And then under the Obama administration, all these social justice activists got put on President Obama's boards. And they now met at the White House. And they had some standing. During George Bush's reign, our presidency, many of the conservative leaders had his ear. They were talking to him. Franklin Graham, James Dobson. And then they rejected Obama. And they lost the ear of the president. So they protested Obama. And now they're lobbying Trump. And the social justice leaders lobbied Obama. And now they're protesting Trump. The church has been reduced to lobbyists and protesters. And nobody is speaking prophetically. Nobody is saying it's the empire we need to wrestle against. And this is what I want to invite you. This is what I want to exhort you. This is what I want to remind you to do. Brothers and sisters, we are disciples. We are the followers. We are the children. We are the followers of Jesus Christ. And yes, he is the Son of God, but he also is the Messiah, and the Messiah came to suffer and to die. Thanks be to God. Amen.